All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here, dealing with subpoint F under Roman numeral 5, the process of reversionism and the toll that it takes on the believer. It obviously takes a toll on his doctrine. Again, if you meet some of these people a year, 2 years down the road, they'll be non-recognizable. And it's going to take a toll on them physically. But emotionally is far just as important as any of these other things, I think, because the person that's run by their emotions is not going to make good decisions, generally speaking. And as the emotions begin to dictate policy, they react something, act out of anger or bitterness or strife or whatever the emotion may be, jealousy, they're not going to make good decisions. And then as their emotions don't line up more and more and more with the Word of God, they have to rationalize it and convince themselves at some level. Again, the person that does this has to, by definition, be very self-deluded. They have to have a view of themselves that absolutely does not correspond to reality. Well, five, the Exodus generation here, as we're ready to continue, demonstrated many of the manifestations of emotional control of the soul. A, rejection of authority. This is one of the things that comes out of this. Because, essentially, the reversionist becomes a law to himself. Nobody can judge him. He's above everybody else. He doesn't have to apply the same doctrines we have to apply. Doesn't have to orient to the same imperatives we have to orient to. And so he becomes his own final authority on everything. Well, the Exodus generation was very much guilty of this. They demonstrated this a lot, by the way. These are not... While I only cite individual verses here or individual instances, these are not isolated things. This happened a lot during the course of these 40 years. And they began right out of the chute. It didn't take them very long to manifest their maladjustment to God. Exodus 15:24, so the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Then he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree and threw it into the waters. And the waters were made sweet. And so you think, okay, well, they see these miracles. This will get to them. Yeah, but they've already seen the Red Sea part. And as they crossed there at the Gulf of Aqaba and went across to the Arabian side of the peninsula. Again, the historical Red Sea crossing points are wrong for those of you that are not familiar with it. They are on the wrong side. Of the peninsula there, the Sinai side that goes over to Arabia is literally where they cross. And if you haven't seen it, when I recommend anything, by the way, I want to make this caveat. I don't mean I endorse everything the person says or thinks, but some people have done good work. I don't have the money, time, or effort to go over and excavate the Gulf of Aqaba and find some of the things that some of these people have found. And God has clearly blessed them at some level. But it's, and I don't remember the exact site, but if, I'm sure if you Google it, check out Ron Wyatt. And he's got a site that shows you where the Exodus crossing was and why. And it's on a beach there at a place called Nuweiba. That there is, as you look across, the Gulf of Aqaba is very deep, by the way, as it runs down here, Saudi Arabia over here. And here's the Sinai Peninsula over here. And then there's another arm over here. This is typically where they had them crossing out of Egypt to this peninsula. Well, that's incorrect. They had gone out of Egypt and wandered and were down up over here. But there's a natural land bridge that extends across here. And it slopes down at a very gentle angle and slopes right back up to the Arabian Peninsula. And on either side of it, the water is, I don't know, hundreds of feet deep. But this, the strong wind blew, as it says, and it essentially parted the waters. The waters stood up, as it says, in heaps. They didn't freeze, per se. I mean, it might have frozen at some level, but it's pretty difficult to freeze seawater. And particularly in that part of the world, it would be difficult. Not to say that that couldn't have happened. But then the people have shown, they've done experiments. I've seen this before. I think it was on Discovery Channel or somewhere. They did experiments and blew water across the shallow deal here, and they literally showed that a wind could cause this phenomena that the Bible describes. And so Ron White did all this research, and strangely enough, down here on this side, he just found multitudes of Egyptian chariot wheels. Go figure. Who would have expected it? Well, the army, of course, rushed right down in there. So they've seen all this. Now they see these waters are bitter. They can't drink them. But Wyatt Archaeology, and I don't know that he's even still alive, but he's got some good information, not only on the Exodus, but on where some of these sites are. The Mount Sinai, the historical place of it, is not correct either. It's on the Arabian Peninsula as well. And he has some very interesting pictures, very interesting detailed research. Again, I'm not sending you there to get theology, but if you're interested in looking at some of that, I think it's fascinating. So they had seen this. They saw. Then they set out from then. They traveled to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai in chapter 16. And the whole congregation grumbled against Moses and Aaron. And so this is, it's one thing after another with these people. You can't please them at a certain point. That's a part of their emotional control of the soul. You can't please them no matter what you do. And the nature of positive volition is such that you can't run them off from the truth. The nature of negative volition is such you can't get them to stay. And the fact is, this is a big dividing point among believers. You can't win them over. Moses couldn't win these people over no matter what he did, no matter how many miracles they saw. They never got one over to Moses. They always resented him and rejected him throughout the 40 years. And they rejected him and resented him right up till the time after about the first year when they had the opportunity to enter Canaan and all that. They were still wanting to get a captain and go back to Egypt. So rejection of authority is a big part of this. Authority is under attack, again, at very many levels, we know. It just goes on out there. And this is a characteristic of these people. B, blaming God or his delegated authorities. Chapter 16 there, verse 2. I just read verses 7 and 8 also. And every time he does something for them, every miracle that happens, the next day, literally, they're back to complaining about their authorities. Nothing makes them happy. No matter how much you do for them, you can't make them happy. And in the morning, you will see the glory of the Lord, verse 7. He hears your grumblings against the Lord. And what are we that you grumble against us? We're just delegated authorities. That's all we are. And your problem is with God. So they continue, again, blaming everybody. It's never their fault. That's another thing you notice with these people. It's never their fault. It's always somebody else. They're very good at shifting the blame. See, lack of faith rest, Exodus 14:10. This they demonstrate repeatedly. Look, you and I come to Bible class and sit here and go through the Christian life, and everything doesn't work out for us perfectly all the time, but we faith rest it, and we stay in fellowship as much as we can, and we continue to plug along. Why can't everybody do that? They could, but the fact is it's a form of negative volition not to. And whatever their blame, it's always, again, somewhere else. As Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. And they became very frightened, so the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, now you think, okay, well, see, they at least prayed. No, they're not praying about this, seriously, they're under fear. And then they accuse Moses once again. Poor Moses. Can you imagine how, you know, I thought my ministry was tough. 2 million negative twits to dog you, and you've got to put up with this for 40 years. I mean, Moses has got to be up for some great rewards. I mean, just to be able to do that. So then they said to Moses, is it because there are no graves in Egypt, you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. Yeah, it'd be better if they killed you than to die out here, right? Better to die as a free man. No, better it's to die as a slave. That's their theology. So they don't faith rest things. They can't faith rest that God's actually in charge of this plan. That God can handle everything. From every authority he delegates right on down to, you know, the least little detail. Our contention is that God's already got it all worked out and that it's unfolding. Oh God, even unbelievers can get this. Have you ever read the Desiderata? It's life is unfolding as it should. Even unbelievers can figure this out sometimes. And you got believers who can't faith rest anything. They've got to deal with it. Well, God has it all under control. He manifests this. You see it in the book of Revelation there when he's got the seven stars. And where are they? In his hand. Those are the seven pastors of the seven churches. He controls all angelic history. He controls all human history. He's got everything under control. But yet the reversionist can't faith rest this. Can't faith rest stuff. Why not? I have to faith rest stuff. I don't. Everything doesn't unfold the way I want it to all the time. Oh, I'm the exception. Everything works out for me perfectly. So they can't faith rest anything. They can't leave it with God. D, living in the past or future. Exodus 14:12. This is them. They want to go back to the past. And we just finished up that verse. I could have added that one, by the way. In Ecclesiastes there, where Solomon says, why are you asking about the former days? Why are they better than now? It is not from wisdom that you say this. People like to live in the past. This is the grudge holder, too. He's constantly living in the past. Again, I've met people over the years, and they are pros at this. They ought to be paid for it. They're that good. They've got grudge holding down to an art form. But again, if you're going to hold a grudge, you're just going to live in the past. That's all you're going to do. And the person you're holding the grudge against, guess what? You're not hurting them. They're still controlling you, believe it or not. So, why bother? E, severe mood swings, Numbers 14, 1 and 39. And that's one of the things, again, you see this emotional control, this emotional revolt that goes on. As the emotions come to dominate these people, they make really stupid choices. And the choices, unfortunately, become increasingly stupid. Numbers 14:1, then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried. Why are they crying? Because they're right up at Kadesh here, about to enter the land of Canaan. And they've sent out spies. Why? Why did you need to send out spies? Didn't God say it's a land flowing with milk and honey and I'm going to give it to you? Yeah, they had to send out spies because they weren't faith resting anything. So they've always got to try to do something because they can't faith rest things. And they lifted up their voices, and Caleb and Joshua, of course, the only two sane ones among them, said, look, yeah, these people are strong, their cities are mighty, we acknowledge that. But if God's given us to them into our hand, we don't have to worry, we don't have to concern ourselves with that. And in order to send his message, when they finally did take the land, after God killed off every one of those negative idiots, when they finally did take the land under the children of the Exodus generation, the first city they attacked was probably the most fortified city of Canaan of its time. And it was in the most prominent place. And that was Jericho. And Jericho, from all practical purposes, from the human viewpoint, was pretty much impenetrable. And so God goes after the biggest city to set the tone for this thing. That's not the biggest, but it was certainly up there. And it was an important city of its time. And he basically demonstrates to all the, as if they didn't know. And see, again, irony is the Canaanites already knew all this. They were already scared to death because they already knew what was going to happen. Israelites couldn't faith rest it, but the Canaanites were living in fear because they knew God was going to give this land to these people. Ironic, isn't it? The unbeliever is better at figuring it out than the believer. Go figure. This is crazy. So they lifted up their voices all night and wept. And all the sons of Israel, here's a new shocker, grumbled against Moses and Aaron. Haven't heard that one before. And the whole congregation said to them, this is their mantra now, would that we had died in the land of Egypt. Moses is probably thinking, God, you're right. Would that you had. I'm down with that, Lord. Or that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us? At least they're blaming the Lord now. Why is the Lord bringing us in this land to fall by the sword? So they said to one another, here's the actual, and now the whole congregation's in anarchy and revolt. Let us appoint us a leader and return to Egypt. We don't like this guy. This is not working out for us. And so we're going to get us a new leader. We don't like the one God sent. So then you have them weeping and crying and carrying on. And then down you look in verses 39 and 40. And Moses had already told them that you're not going to get this. God's not going to give the land to you now. Now he's changed his mind. He's going to kill y'all. And when Moses spoke to the word, these words to the sons of Israel, the people mourned greatly. Now one night they're sitting up crying and weeping and complaining. And the next morning they get up and they're very energetic. They rose up early and went to the ridge of the hill country saying, "Here we are." Yeah, here you are, all right. Here we are. We have indeed sinned, but we will go up to the place which the Lord has promised. So now they're all psyched. After all this, after this year of complaining and whining and griping and failing to believe God every time, can't faith rest anything, now they're psyched and they're going to apply. Wow. How long is this going to last, you think? Not very long. So he says, "Look, do not go up. Why are you transgressing the commandment of the Lord when it will not succeed? Do not go up or you will be struck down for your before your enemies." So all of this, and then he warns them, and in verse 45, the Amalekites and Canaanites who lived in the hill country came down and struck them and beat them down as far as Hormah. It came true. They didn't get it. Here he basically then prepares them that, look, okay, I'm not going to give you this land. And so they're, one minute they're psyched, the next minute they're mad. One minute they're happy, the next minute they're sad. And this is the reversionist, though. They live in this la-la land of emotional mood swings. And then F, complaining, that's throughout. You can see Exodus 16:3. They're constantly complaining. They became professional gripers. They're not only professional grudge holders against Moses, because, you know, he brought them out here to kill them. Now they're professional gripers. Nothing pleases them. And that's the point with some people. There's nothing you could do to please them. You can try everything. You can give them every grace. You can give them every opportunity. And there's nothing you can do to please them. Nothing's going to be good enough. And short of, you know, whatever it is they think they want. And even if they got what they wanted, guess what? Won't be happy. Doesn't change. So G, as this process continues down the gory road, you got two paths in life, the glory road or the gory road. You pick. And further rejection of doctrine becomes the normative response. One, during this process, if the believer was intellectually honest, if, and a big if, and he's not, second class condition, the believer that's going through this process is not intellectually honest. Do not expect him to look at the truth and come up with the same conclusions you come up with, because he's not intellectually honest. His emotions are corrupting his mentality and his intellect. That's another whole problem with this. The intellect becomes corrupted. If the believer was honest, he would readily acknowledge the fact that he is not as interested in Bible doctrine as he had previously been. Hebrews 10:32 and following. Do you remember when you first got with the truth? Do you remember how excited you were? Remember when you thought, "Man, I can't wait to get to Bible class." You know? And then you think, and now you think, you know, as you settle into it, it's not that, as though that emotion doesn't pass normally. It does. The excitement fades. But when the excitement fades, I mean, that's the real test of your positive volition. Okay, do you still want the truth? It's not. See, I remember, you know, you go to Bible class. Every class was great because everything was new. You were constantly learning something new. Then over the years, as you get exposed to the truth and you build up your doctrinal grid, your frame of reference and all that, then Bible class isn't always new. So, and so to combat this, some pastors have embarked on a creative process that I like to call, "Let's rename everything." And so they're constantly trying to come up with new nomenclature to keep it exciting and fresh. Well, guess what? At a certain level, it's manna. What can you do with this manna? Well, I can make a hat. I can eat it. I can make a brooch. Well, it's just manna. And it's plain vanilla Bible doctrine. What do you want me to say? Well, let's spice it up a little. Let's add some hot sauce. We'll have a spicy hot manna for supper. And then we'll have, you know, sweet and sour manna. What's the secret ingredient, Chef? Manna. What can you do with manna? If you watch the Home Cooking Channel, for those of you that don't get it. So here's your secret ingredient, manna. Manna day. Manna every day. I have hot manna, sweet and spicy manna, banana bread. What can you do with that? Well, there's pastors that do this, and it's called rename everything. It And so I don't feel the need to do that. And at a certain level, if doctrine doesn't stimulate you on its own, it's not up to me to try to put it in a fresh package for you. If your positive doctrine stimulating enough on its own, the truth has a ring to it. Well, if the believer was honest, he's not as interested as he was. So the emotional joy of it all fades at a certain level. But this happens in every area of life. You ever buy a new car? How psyched were you then? You were going to wash it every week? And that lasted for a while, right? You were going to keep it clean. You weren't going to let it get messy inside. And you take really good care of it, and then you kind of, I don't feel like washing it this week. How were you when you got married? Giddy. I'm in love. Wow. Guess what? After about 50 loads of laundry, 900 breakfasts, and all that, well, that's sort of that emotional psych fades, doesn't it? Sure, but if you're committed to your marriage and you're in love, then we'll see if you're in love. We'll see, because time will tell. And so, again, emotional things come and go. And everybody goes through this. Well, some people, when they stop being interested in doctrine, they also stop attending class. They begin to miss. They begin to substitute other things. They begin to rationalize it. And so Hebrews 10, 32 and following here. But remember the former days, when after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings. And so you had various tribulations, as these Hebrew believers did, various pressures and stuff that they faced, but it didn't deter them. It didn't deter them one bit. Partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. You know, you remember too, when you first got on doctrine, I don't know about you, but I was psyched, man. I remember the first Bible class I ever went to. I was just, you know, <it's> great. If you're seeing, there's this new character on Saturday Night Live, and she had a skit where she was doing that. We're gonna have a surprise party. Oh, a surprise party! Well, I was like that with doctrine, and I was sitting there and I was looking around. I thought, I am in the presence of spiritual greatness. The same people 3 months later, I couldn't stand. Of course. And I thought to myself, God, I am so for it. I mean, look at these people. These people are serious about the truth. And I felt very unworthy to even be there. You think I'm not making this up, and I'm not exaggerating. I'm serious. This was exactly the way it was. And I thought, okay, I'm now a partaker of those that are taking in the truth. Great. These people, and I looked around and I saw people, and I won't name names because, some of them are still there. And I looked at them and I thought, man, these people are spiritual giants. Well, it turns out they weren't, all of them. And, you kind of get that psych of, oh, God, you know, or at least I did. I was pretty emotionally stimulating for me. And shares with those who were so treated. For you joyfully showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that for yourselves you have a better possession and a lasting one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has great reward. Remember how confident you used to be in doctrine? Well, what's changed? Well, people did stuff to me. Okay. Does that mean doctrine's not true? Bad things happened. Didn't work out the way I thought it was going to. So? So what were you in it for? I was in it to get my way. Well, if that's why you're in it, then you're in it for the wrong reason. That's not why you're supposed to be in it. So you worship God as long as he does it your way? Well, that's a pretty shaky faith. And I don't think God's going to honor that too much. I'll do it as long as God does it my way, but if he quits, I'm going to take my ball and leave. There you go. You're six again. So again, these people, they were psyched about it. They were willing to make any sacrifice. They wouldn't miss Bible class because of work. Again, we're not saying you can't ever miss because of a job. Obviously, a job could take you out. But if the job is suddenly taking you out of a class every week and you're not dealing with it at some level or not praying about it, that's a problem. And if you're thinking, oh, I don't have to go to class tonight, that's good. Yeah, see, that attitude betrays something. And you look for excuses and reasons why you don't have to go. Well, I've got hangnail. Well, I can't go to class with this. You know, I got a headache. I'm tired. I have taught with headaches. I have taught exhausted. I have taught frustrated. I've taught discouraged. I managed to get here and do it. Everything is not. There's a lot of out of season times when you're a pastor. Trust me. You'll have to trust me since none of you are pastors. But there's a lot of out of season times, and it's for a lot of reasons. But I find myself, I've gone through, you go through periods in your Christian life, and there's ups and downs to it, unfortunately. It's not always just a smooth, steady climb. And so there's been periods where I was not nearly as psyched about teaching, not nearly as anxious to do it. Well, that betrays a problem with me, not with God, or not with the doctrine. I have to say, okay, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be diligent. I'm supposed to be hot for this. God doesn't care for lukewarm. He says it makes him sick. And there's only one condition, in fact, God cares for, and that's hot. When he says, I wish you were hot or cold, do you think he really means I wish you were cold? I don't think he means that. I think he means I wish you were hot. And that's what God's looking for. Well, people they go through periods where you're not a sight. Well, that's when you have to be challenged yourself. You're like a runner, again, in a marathon. You're going to go through a period where there's nobody cheering you on. You're out there by yourself. Your legs are killing you. Your eggs may be hurting too. I don't know. You're a female runner, I guess. My ovaries are killing me. Well, your legs hurt. Your lungs burn. You think you can't take another step. And then that's when you're tested as a runner. You hit the wall. And so you have to say, okay, this is when you've got to dig deep. And there's going to come times in your Christian life where you've got to dig deep. And reversionists aren't willing to do it. The rest of us have to do it. And I'm going to tell you, it's not always easy. And these people were psyched. They were losing their property, losing their jobs, losing their social life, being thrown into jail, friends in jail, all these kinds of things. And he says, don't throw away your confidence. You had confidence in doctrine. Don't lose that. Doctrine still works. Yes, but I've had too many tests. How many did Jesus have? What's too many? How are you going to quantify that? Read 2 Corinthians and see how many tests Paul had. You spent a day and a night in the deep, clinging onto a board for your life? You haven't had that one yet, huh? You received the 39 lashes from the Jews 5 times? And all the things that he endured, the dangers from robbers, dangers from countrymen. I mean, Paul literally did not know who to trust on many occasions. And then at least you find out who you can trust. And so again, you have to get sight. And when you sense that, hey, I'm starting to wane here, you better buckle down. And if you don't buckle down, you're a candidate for this process we're discussing. And so it is a challenge. And again, you have these times when, it's hard. Sometimes it's easy. Sometimes everything falls into place and it's just great. Well, 2, the believer then begins to rationalize his indifference to the intake and application of doctrine with various excuses. And that's all they ever are, is excuses. If you can get here and I can get here, then why can't everybody else get here? Because they're rationalizing. They've convinced themselves that it's okay. Well, guess what? It's not okay. Not ever going to say it's okay. 3, as his priorities become more corrupted, the believer finds he does not have the time or inclination to attend Bible class, listen to the class he missed, or apply under his spiritual gift. And everybody, I think, goes through this at some level. But the positive believer buckles down, gets back with it, and says, okay, look, I've got to intensify here. I need to knuckle down. I remember, if I missed a class back when I first started, boy, I had to get the tape. And I had to make it up before the next class. And we were having 5 classes a week then, so it was sometimes a challenge. And then, after 4 or 5 years, you think, I missed, okay. What did he cover? Well, he was just doing a doctrine. Oh, I don't need to listen to that. Really, that's a weird attitude. If I bothered cooking the meal, at least you could do is eat it. I don't have time to apply. I've applied enough. Well, look for opportunities. Instead of looking for opportunities, they're rationalizing away why they don't want any. 4, however, the reversionist has the time to read the latest cosmic novel. Stephen King's got one coming out. Keeping Up with Harry Potter? Watch television for hours, attend sporting events, concerts, or movies. And again, we're not against any of these things in their place. What I'm saying is I've watched believers over the years that have time to do all this stuff, and they couldn't make it to Bible class. And this betrays something about them. Shop for hours and associate with other reversionists. They got plenty of time for that. They managed to get that done. They managed to hang out with people. They make time for what's important. It's just that doctrine isn't important anymore. And they're not going to tell you that. They're going to say, no, I'm okay with God. No, we're fine. I'm all right. You're not all right. You're deluded. 5, during this process, they often begin to manifest problems with other positive believers and or the pastor, but gravitate to others that are negative or going negative. And again, to me, the ones going negative that haven't really manifested their colors, they're the most dangerous. They haven't really shown what they are yet. They're headed down a particular path. You just don't know it. They haven't made it public yet. And so you begin, that's why you have to listen carefully and evaluate people carefully. Don't be too quick to jump on their bandwagon. Just because they jump up and proclaim their positive volition to the high heavens doesn't make it so. Oh, I'm fine. I just don't attend class anymore and the pastor's an idiot, but I'm fine. No, you're not. No, you're not. Where did you get that doctrine? It certainly wasn't from me. 6, during this time they may take issue with the content of the pulpit, questioning the direction the pastor teacher has chosen, what book he is teaching, what doctrines he covers, etc. And at a certain point they get to where the point is they're not pleased with any of it. It wouldn't matter what I was doing. If I could stand up here on my head and juggle while I was teaching, it wouldn't be good enough. And they want to be entertained. You know. If I could sing an opera, would that make you better for you? I can't. How's it got to be done to make you happy? And that's where the fundies drop the ball big time. They're always trying to keep people happy. You know, I want you to come here, sit because you're positive. Be relaxed, obviously. I don't want you to be too relaxed. But, you know, I figure my experience has been, and I think this is borne out by cosmic wisdom even, that people learn in a more relaxed environment. It doesn't have to be tense and uptight all the time. And so we have a particular decorum. You can't get too relaxed. I don't want you smoking a cigarette and drinking a beer. Kicking your seat back, putting your feet up, folding your arms, and taking a nap. That's a little too relaxed. But other than that, you know, I think they've pretty much demonstrated that people learn if they're relaxed better than they do if they're tense and uptight. Somebody holding a stick over their head. That was the way they used to teach, you know, reading and writing and arithmetic. Taught to the tune of a hickory stick. You learned or else. I don't want to have that attitude. I assume you're here because you want to learn. Well, again, this idea of what book am I teaching? Well, guess what? Either God the Holy Spirit, he's led me all these years, either he still is or he isn't. And my contention is that he is. Of course I'd say that. I'd expect that out of me. Well, what do you want me to say? No, I'm an idiot. I'm completely blowing it. I don't know what book I should be doing. I pray about this all the time. It's constantly on my prayer list. Where to go next? What to do next? Where God, you know, what's congregation need? I don't know. And I have to rely on the leading of the Holy Spirit. That's all I can do. During this process, and again, you know, you'll have, and I recognize pastors can go too slow. Now, some pastors wouldn't like me saying this, but the fact is I've seen pastors drag their feet. And that's not good. That's kind of boring. I got bored with it sometimes, occasionally. I say, you know, come on, move on. You know, half the congregation had missed one night, so spend the next night reviewing. Well, don't punish me. I was here. You know, they missed. Let them get the tape. And that's always been my mantra, get the tape. If you missed, get the tape. See, you can tell how old I am. Now it's get the CD or get the real audio. But the point is, you know, and I recognize pastors can draw stuff out, and that's not edifying either. But, you know, I've had people complain because I went too slow, but I've had other people complain because I went too fast. Well, I got to figure out the pace myself, unfortunately. I don't know any other way to do it. I bet you work at your pace on your job, don't you? Pretty much. I bet you work at whatever pace you think you have to work at. Well, I try to do the same thing. I don't want to drag it out necessarily and make it boring. That's another whole thing. Just because you don't have to reinvent the wheel all the time and make it new, on the other hand, you shouldn't be boring. You know, I've listened to people talk, some speakers, and I mean, they put you to sleep in 5 minutes. It's monotone. It's like Mr. Mackey, get excited. Mr. Mackey never gets excited. Mr. Garrison, he's on edge. Mr. Mackey, it's always the same. Now, kids. You know, I've heard people talk in their you know, there's a lot of things that go into this. I'm not necessarily the best public speaker. You don't have to be. But certainly, I think that there's an art to doing it right. But when people are going to come, you know, if they're constantly taking issue with what book you're in, you know, I recognize that, again, there's excesses and abuses. I recognize them. I try not to engage in them. But I do recognize them. And I try to learn from what I perceive to be the mistakes of others. If it takes you 20 years to get through a book, they're not going to remember the beginning of it by the time you're done with it. I mean, that's ludicrous. And so I've tried to maintain a particular pace. You know, the more I study and the better I get at it, the pace has slowed some. I acknowledge that. But I, for the first 10 or 15 years, at first 15 years, I think, I checked it out, and we were going about a chapter a month was about what we averaged. And I'll check it in 20 years, and I'll see what kind of pace we've averaged. I keep track of that stuff, believe it or not. You say, I do too. I've got it at home in a spreadsheet. How often you said this? How often you taught that? You've repeated yourself. Well, thank God you never do. Everybody repeats themselves. The Bible's filled with repetition. Jesus repeated himself. Oh, I would have had trouble with that. I would have told Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount, I already heard this. You need to teach me something new. Well, again, I've heard people take issue with all kinds of things. Guess what? It's the pastor's call. And I think for the most part, all you guys are oriented to, and I'm not having problems. But the reversionist, he's not. And again, the problem with leadership, or one problem with leadership that you face, is when people are upset with God, they're probably going to point to you. They're not going to admit that it's God they're upset with. They're going to point to somebody else. It's somebody else's fault. It's never them. Seven, here, during this process, the reversion, whatever doctrine the believer had begins to be corrupted and may be rejected and even purged from his thinking. Mark 4, 24 and 25. And there are believers that have doctrines, they start to reject one, and it's like a domino effect. Some others start to fall with them. There are believers, I know believers, at one time their goal was to be a friend of God. That was their biggest goal. And when we did the book of Genesis, that had a big impact on them. They saw that Abraham was a friend of God. Had one believer, he's no longer here, so that's what I want. I want to be a friend of God. Well, you're not, unfortunately. It's too bad. And doctrine's gotten corrupted in his thinking. And doctrines that he once embraced, he rejects now. That's the danger of this. It's a dangerous game. Mark 4, 24 and 25. And he was saying to them, take care what you listen to. This is what, as a pastor, again, we walk a fairly fine line, but we have to say this to you. Take care of what you listen to, what you expose yourself to. There's a lot of danger out there. There's a lot of false doctrine. Even among people who are, quote, doctrinal teachers. I was listening to one guy the other day. I was checking out something because somebody contacted me from some other church, not anyone we're familiar with. It was out in California somewhere. And she said, oh, you know, you teach the same thing about Christmas we teach. Yeah, okay, good. And it's great to see that, you know, people are out there, other people are positive. Yeah, thank you, fine. She said, well, here's a link to our, you know, church and blah, blah, blah. And their website was, well, it was bad, frankly. All they had was the Bible classes. They didn't have any doctrines put. Didn't have any. You couldn't find out anything about the church at all, as to what it was, what they stood for, any of that. It was just links for people to get the classes. And that was the sum total of their website. And so I went and listened to one of the classes, and this guy was teaching rebound. He was actually, one of it was the sin unto death. He was teaching that particular deal. So the same terminology we use. But then I heard him say something, and it gave me pause. He said, you got to learn how to rebound properly. Rebound properly? Well, what is there to it? I thought it was just confessing my sins. Oh, no, it's not just confessing your sins. In a sense, he's adopted some of the Fundy attitude that you got to promise never to do it again. You can't confess a sin you're going to commit again. Don't think God's going to get you back in fellowship. Uh-oh. I'm really in trouble because I think I've committed most of them by now. Oh, don't laugh. You have too. So I'm like, rebound properly. Now, obviously, if you go rebound knowing that 5 minutes later you plan on going out and doing it again, does God honor that? I don't know. I would assume if you confess your sins, he's got to be faithful and righteous to forgive them. Again, other factors notwithstanding, like you're not in unforgiveness yourself. We know then he doesn't forgive them. Okay, I recognize that. You can't be bitter and unforgiving and expect God to forgive you. Okay, I see that. But, okay, I committed a sin. Whatever it was, I lost my temper, got angry. Now, I can't confess that sin if I ever plan on getting angry again. Well, I don't plan on getting angry. It just happens. I mean, if all you people would do perfect all the time, I wouldn't have any problems. And if everybody out there in the cosmos would just stay out of my grill, I wouldn't have any problems. In other words, if I lived on a desert island and was completely isolated, I'd still have a problem with my sin nature. And that's of course, see, that's the ascetic approach to life. This was promoted much by, the Gnostics and even into the rise of the monastic orders. Separate from the world and you'll attain the sin nature. No, you won't. You'll still have a sin nature. You may not have as much sensory input to stir it up, but you'll still have it. And you'll still sin. So, again, pay attention to what you listen to. I've heard people use the same terminology, but, I mean, that was a weird spin on rebound I'd never heard. But that's, some people, they have their own little weird spin on stuff. And maybe he teaches other stuff right, I don't know. But that gave me pause, and I thought, man, I don't want to listen to this guy. Because I don't believe that. I think that's a fundamental fault right there. That's kind of important if you're telling believers that you got to rebound properly. The word homologeo means to name, cite, confess. It literally means to say the same thing as. It means to agree with God that you've sinned. And if I agree with God that I've sinned, how I understand the verse is that he forgives me. If I confess my sins, third class condition, maybe I will, maybe I won't. But if I do, then he is faithful and righteous to forgive me and cleanse me from all unrighteousness. But did you rebound properly? Well, see, there's stuff like that out there. And you'd hear the same terminology and you think, oh, it's another doctrinal church just like ours. That's not. To me, that's a little bit weird. So take care of what you listen to. By your standard and measure, it will be measured to you. And more will be given to you besides. For whoever has, to him shall more be given. And whoever does not have, even what he has, shall be taken away from him. And I believe this to be a promise of further revelation and teaching as you grow in the Christian life. You're going to find more out more and more and more about God and his plan and the details of it and all that. But the one who doesn't want it, even what he has can be taken away from him. And that sounds like to me an active process where God's taking it away from him. They aren't just jettisoning it. It sounds like an active judgment to me. If somebody else is taking it away, now if he said he can lose it, that's a different thing. That sounds much more passive. But this sounds like God actively judging the believer. 8, you may hear the reversionist actively rejecting doctrines he once believed, espousing human viewpoint to replace that doctrine, and in worst case scenario, even replacing the truth with the doctrines of demons. Somebody was telling me about a person that was another guy, another pastor in another church, and he said, this person peeled off and now all of a sudden they're advocating vegetarianism. He didn't used to believe that. And that's a doctrine of demons, we know, from right out of 1 Peter 4, 1 Timothy 4. Vegetarianism as a, quote, religious way of life is a doctrine of demons. And so are other things, but that's the example of it. People can get into all kinds of weird stuff. 9, it should be noted that some reversionists, particularly religious reversionists, often do not manifest overt antagonism toward doctrine. They may simply revert to an inferior form of Christianity, compromising the doctrines of faith with various forms of inferior or false doctrines. Revelation 2, 14 and 15. And so, again, particularly today, and this has been going on, I say today, but I've observed this over the last 20 years. And that is this swing back towards fundiism that we came out of. Let's compromise and go back at some level. And my answer to that is hell no. I'm never going back. And if people want to go back, they can go back. I'm not. I came out of the camp, and I recognized the camp was poisoned. And once the camp is poisoned, you got to get out of it. Because the camp's not going to change. And that's the Hebrews exhortation. Let us go to him outside the camp. And the Fundy camp is poisoned. And it's never going to improve. It's always going to be what it is. Revelation 2, 14 and 15. But I have a few things against you. Because you have some who hold the doctrine of Balaam, hold the teaching of Balaam. These are believers now. Again, these are written to local churches, so these are believers he's talking about. Who've now reverted to this form of monetary reversionism and advocating that as a doctrine. That's what Balaam was. He was a monetary reversionist. And then this idea of stumbling blocks. Who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit acts of immorality. So you also have some who in the same way hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans. And so believers began to endorse and embrace these false doctrines. And the pastor's job when he sees this, of course, is to deal with this decisively. You can't tolerate this for very long. You can't tolerate people actively promoting what you know are false doctrines. And heresy has a way of destroying a local church. It has ways of taking it down. And this is why doctrinal purity is so important. No, I'm not going to go back and compromise. I believe we've got the doctrines of the faith. Whatever tweaking we may need to do, I think we have a fundamentally sound doctrinal grid. Again, it doesn't mean we can't grow and learn more and improve it. But is it overall wholesale right? Pretty much, yeah, I think so. If I didn't, believe me, I'd be doing something else. I wouldn't be promoting what I didn't embrace and endorse myself. God, I'm not an Amway salesman. Well, 10, others may exhibit the lukewarm syndrome by leaving a sound doctrinal church, moving to a non-doctrinal church and engaging in the overt observances of Christianity, but lacking the true substance and power of Bible doctrine. Let's look at 3:16 since we're here, and then we'll go to the 2 Timothy 3:5. 3:16, so because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot. In other words, they don't go out there and go back to the cosmos and just blow Christianity off completely. They don't go, quote, as it were, cold. They continue to maintain some level, albeit in their mind real, but to God, odious. They believe that somehow they're still in this deal of I'm pleasing God in this lukewarm state. You're not pleasing God as a lukewarm believer. These verses completely militate against that. That's not, you can't please God if you're lukewarm. So because you're lukewarm, I will vomit you out of my mouth. A pretty gross, metaphor here, but that's what it means. You make me nauseous. You ever drank any, lukewarm milk that's just about to go bad? Somebody has. Well, it's gross. It'll make you want to puke. Well, this is how Jesus views the religious reversionist. He's lukewarm. He's going through the overt actions. He's still trying to maintain it. But he has no zeal for doctrine. No zeal for the truth. But yet he won't go out there and just become like a full-blown hedonist. Some people, they blow off doctrine. They just go out and they become immoral, get into drugs, alcohol, do whatever they want, go out there and just destroy their lives. They're better off than the lukewarm believer, believe it or not. They'll probably die quicker. But you never know. And then also the last one for today, 2 Timothy 3:5. So people continue to go through these overt forms, but they are just that. They're forms. They're ritual without reality at that point. What'd you do today? I huddled around a tape recorder with a bunch of other believers. Well, you're still a reversionist. You're not under face-to-face teaching, and you embraced that doctrine at one time. Well, here, holding to a form of godliness, although they have denied its power, avoid such men as these. The power of doctrine is doctrine. The power in what we have in the inner man is the doctrine. It is the Bible that we teach and believe and apply, ultimately, hopefully. Well, H, rejection of doctrine and perpetuated carnality then began to work in tandem, causing further rejection of doctrine and increasing perpetuated carnality. And again, they may rebound during this time, get in fellowship momentarily, but how much good does it do them? Functionally, they're wasting their time. Even though, you know, they're in fellowship for a moment, I guess. Now, there are people that advocate that if you're in fellowship, you don't have to do anything and you get SG3. See, I don't advocate that. I believe you actually have to be applying some doctrine to get SG3. I believe we're rewarded according to our deeds, our works. You have to be actually be thinking. I mean, and you could be watching TV and applying doctrine mentally. That's actually a work. I mean, it's a mental work, I grant you. It's not hard work. It's not like, you know, applying doctrine by working on a grounds crew or teaching prep school or something. Obviously, those are more intensive labor. So, but I can sit there and watch TV and apply doctrine. Did I get rewarded for that? If I was in fellowship, I believe so. But I don't believe just being in fellowship gets you SG3. So the reversionist is not getting SG3. He's in fellowship momentarily. Again, until he sins the next time. But if he's perpetuating carnality by violation of known doctrines, how long is he in fellowship? Well, my contention is he's right back out. Just as quick as he rebounds, he's right back out. God forgives him momentarily, and then boom, he's right back out. So, again, these work in tandem, and then they reject more doctrine, get more rationalization, and out of fellowship more and more and more, until eventually it's, for all intents and purposes, they're perpetually out. And at that level, then you're pretty much done. Okay, well, we'll stop there and we'll continue on here with this on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God, the Holy Spirit, sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.